Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the September 27th forum featuring Visa Chairman and CEO Al Kelly. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Al Kelly engaged in a fireside chat with John Fish, Chairman and CEO of Suffolk. The conversation touched on a variety of subjects, including leadership, the current payments ecosystem, including cryptocurrency and blockchain, and Visa's 60th year in business. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club.
He's worked extensively and tirelessly on the integration of Visa Europe, which has opened up whole new channels for the company, and also put a lot of emphasis on India. But one thing that Al, as a CEO, really done and is known by his people and his board, his real focus on innovation. How does innovation impact his payment systems on a going forward basis? And that's one of the things we'd like to talk about today. I just ask for a show of hands. If people in this room has a Visa, please raise your hand.
Thank you.
But what I would say is that most people think about Visa as a plastic card, and it's really not. Al's mission is to connect the world to the most innovative, reliable, and secure digital payment network that enables individuals, businesses, and economies to thrive. Can you talk about Visa and the payment system in America and in the world, Al? And what are the major differences between Visa and financial institutions?
Well, we are, at its core, we're a B2B technology company. We also try to think of ourselves as a commerce solution provider. And we also try to think of ourselves as a consumer brand. The reality is we're very different than banks. Most people talk about their Visa card and unbelievably, they actually don't even, in many cases, know the bank behind it. And the bank behind it is critical because they are the actual issuer of the card and they're the ones who take on the credit risk. One of the great things about our model is that we have no credit risk. And until we bought Europe, we actually had no debt, much to the chagrin of some of our investors who would actually like to see us have more debt. The business is about sitting between businesses and consumers who buy services and goods from people, and we at its core process those. Last year there were 166 billion transactions on Visa cards around the world, and $10.3 trillion of funds moved, and every evening we settle in 160 different currencies, all of those transactions. And our system is able to process 65,000 transactions a second. So luckily, we have plenty of capacity to get there. During the kind of holiday season in the US, we might get to the area of 15, 16,000 transactions a second. So we have plenty of capacity to grow. We're a business that is changing tremendously, obviously. The reality is that the clock speed, I've been involved in payments now for about 35 years, and what's happened in the last 3 years dwarfs everything that happened in the 32 years before that. And things are very different around the world. Everybody in this room largely would have a US view into what credit cards and payments are all about, but we operate in every country around the world except the six that the US has sanctions against. So we're not in Cuba, Crimea, Syria, Sudan, Iran, or North Korea, but we operate in every single other country in the world and every territory in the world. And Africa is very nascent. You know, Africa is a place where I look 5 to 20 years out and say that's where we're gonna get a lot of growth. You mentioned India. On the day of the US presidential election of November 8th of 2016, certainly, the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States was an event, but so was the fact that Prime Minister Modi on that very day took the two most popular forms of paper currency immediately out of the system in India. And it caused, in typical Indian fashion, chaos for 2 weeks as people didn't know how to deal with it. But it's an example of a very activist government trying to push the gray economy out to the side by making more money transparent through digital electronic means. Yet India now is got somewhere went from about 1 million places that accepted Visa cards to we're about 2.5 million, but it's a mere drop in the ocean. I mean, India will be a place where we'll be able to grow for the better part of the next couple of decades because it's just that big a market.
1.4 billion people, roughly?
Exactly.
Staggering.
Staggering. Yeah.
People talk quite a bit about the Great Depression and then the Great Recession and also about the great disruption that's going on right now. And you take a look at like Apple, Google, Amazon, and they really truly continue to transform the world in many ways. And fintechs, which you're very familiar with, are clearly some of the great disruptors going on right now in your industry. How do fintechs figure into the Visa strategy, and what is the potential for disruption?
So I have a very clear philosophy that I believe and I want our company to believe, which is I want to be the most open company in the world. I want to declare everybody a friend until they prove that they're an enemy. And so we want to engage with all these fintechs. This morning in the paper, you might have seen a company called Stripe, which was founded by two Irish brothers, John and Patrick Collison, who are in their late 20s. And they did a fundraise yesterday that valued Stripe at $20 billion. And Stripe is a company that enables you, if you want to set up an e-commerce website in your home, they will facilitate payments being able to be accepted on your site. They're kind of a one-stop shop for that. We have a very close relationship with them. There's a company called Klarna in the Nordics in Europe that is offering the ability, when you buy something online, that at the point of purchase, you can decide to extend payment if you want to, or you can pay in full. And they're a company we invested in and have a great relationship with. So our view, John, is that we should engage with everybody. The payments world is a very unique business from two perspectives. One is that it requires many players in order to operate. Yeah. If you didn't have a lot of different players in the ecosystem, it would fall apart. The other great thing about it, you mentioned Pepsi. I started my career at Pepsi, and there's a business where there's only so many people in the world that are going to drink sugared water every day. And so if you work at Pepsi or Coke, you come to work every day figuring out how to nudge one basis point of share from the other guy, how to get one more inch of shelf space in a supermarket for your product. The payments ecosystem is growing. I don't spend any time thinking about market share. I think I come to work every day thinking about how am I going to grow the market. And the market's growing tremendously. And the biggest competitor we have in the world is Cash Inc. Cash Inc. doesn't have any infrastructure. It doesn't have any management. But last year, $17 trillion in the consumer space was still spent on cash around the world, and including $4 trillion here in the United States. So fintechs are a reality. I actually tell people that I think Visa is the greatest fintech story in the world. We've only been a public company for 10 years. It was an association before that. It wasn't a commercial enterprise. Yeah. And in those 10 years, it's had just massive growth. And we had, when the company went public in 2008, we had 5,000 employees. Today we have, I'm not even sure we add so many every day, but we're coming up on 17,000. We were operating in far less countries than we were, and our volumes were much less, and our stock is up almost 1,200% from the time the company went public on March 28th of 2008. So we're a great fintech story, and by definition, since we only had 5,000 employees and we have 17,000, you can imagine how many young people we have. I'm an old man at Visa, probably an old man everywhere, but certainly at Visa, and I'm an old guy. But there's so much enthusiasm amongst our young engineers. I said 17,000 people, we have 8,000 of our 17,000 work in technology. They're, you know, most of them are engineers, although we have a massive amount of people who work in cybersecurity. I just signed off last week. October 1st is the beginning of our next fiscal year, and I just signed off on our cybersecurity budget for next year. We will have 840 people next year fully dedicated to cybersecurity alone, because the trust of the ecosystem is so important. Yeah. So I've rambled on
your question. It's interesting you talk about technology. I think if you asked a lot of the CEOs in this room what they would describe their company 10 years ago and what they describe them today is probably totally different. Even as a construction company, I consider ourselves to be a technology company. And those are the tools that we use today ubiquitously throughout the United States. If we didn't have those tools, we couldn't operate efficiently and effectively. And I would assume the same thing for your company, Al.
No question. I mean, it's funny, I'm very proud of the fact that Denise Morrison is joining our board in 2 weeks. And we've been out looking for a couple of board members.
By the way, BC trustee.
Another BC trustee. I go out and I'll talk to people about our company and our board, and I'll hear people say, oh, I want to go on the board of one of those digital companies. And it infuriates me, because that's exactly what we are, is a digital company. And many, many, many of our transactions today are not on actual cards. And it's fascinating. If you talked about fintechs, I just want to tell a quick story about China. If you went to China today, it would feel like a very, really foreign as it relates to payments. There are virtually no cards in China. And in the last 24 months, talk about disruption, in the last 24 months, Alipay and WeChat, Alipay being a commerce network that morphed into taking payments, and WeChat, which is a super app. And if you haven't ever heard of WeChat, the New York Times has a video that's about 3.5 minutes long, and I encourage you to just Google WeChat New York Times and give a sense of what's happening. In 3.5 minutes, you'll get a sense of what's happening technology-wise in China. But both of these companies got into payments, and the Chinese banks were asleep at the switch, largely because companies like ours are locked out of China. So Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover are all locked out of China. We've been trying to get a license for 15 years. And needless to say, the mood right now in terms of giving us a license is not very good. So what's happened in those 24 months, WeChat and Alipay took 25 share points, not 25 basis points, 25 share points from the banks. And all of that volume is just sitting in their wallets. So it doubly hurt the banks, because they're not only losing the payments, but people are Chinese citizens are transferring money from their banks to the wallets, electronic virtual wallets of WeChat and Alipay, parking their money there and then shopping from that wallet. So the banks lost deposits and they've lost transaction revenue associated with each of those transactions. That's disruption. Yeah. And I was in Beijing about, I don't know, maybe 4 months ago, and I spent 3.5 hours on a Saturday morning, and I just went around Beijing. I went to high-end malls, I went to local street vendors, I went to standalone stores, I went to a Kentucky Fried Chicken, I went to a Starbucks, just to see how people shopped. And in 4 hours, I never saw a credit card, never saw one.
I'm glad Brian Moynihan is not here. He's speaking next time, so we'll keep
it. Brian and I talk about it a lot.
All good.
Brian knows where things are going.
Al, interesting is that you're coming up on a major milestone in the company. Visa is celebrating their 60th anniversary. Very few brands achieve that 60th level. In fact, my industry, the average life of a contract is 7 years. Okay? How has the industry evolved, Al, over the last 60 years? And how do you continue in the progress and successes that you've had today on a going forward basis?
It's a great question, and one that obviously, as the CEO, I have to focus on all the time. It's interesting, in the first 30 to 35 years of the industry, all that was really happening was the industry was trying to get more places to accept credit cards. Because when it started, very few places accepted. So if you carried a credit card, you'd use it where you could, but you had to use a lot of cash. Then, in the period of kind of the mid-1980s to about 5 years ago, all the emphasis was on the value in the product. So what's the APR on your credit card? Does it have an annual fee or does it not have an annual fee? Does it have reward points or airline points or hotel points? Does it offer cash back? Does it offer some generic reward system? What kind of other bells and whistles and features are in the card? But the clock speed has just accelerated incredibly over the last 3 to 5 years. And now people are focused on how can I do payments off of my telephone or my mobile phone? How can I have a better point of sale experience? One of the things that I'm maniacal about is that the moment of truth when I actually go to pay is something the payments industry actually never actually spent much time thinking about. And as a result, particularly here in the United States, we're way behind the rest of the world in terms of tap and pay, contactless cards. I was with a Polish bank CEO yesterday. 85% of the transactions in Poland today are tap and pay. So you don't swipe, you don't dip your card, you just tap it. The card never leaves your hand, doesn't have to be turned over to the merchant. Canada to our north is 55% tap and pay. Australia is 90% tap and pay. Russia just crossed 40% tap and pay. We're 0.1%. And the interesting thing is that the system, the infrastructure in the United States is largely piped to actually support tap and pay today, meaning the terminals are able to absorb it. But the banks have not been issuing the cards that have the capability to send the near field communication to facilitate tap and pay. And they're now beginning to do it. Spent a better part of one of the biggest things I've been working on the last year is talking to the bank CEOs in the United States, getting them to come along. If you have me back in 5 years, I'll bet you the United States is upwards of at least 50% tap and pay by then, and maybe even higher, depending upon how quickly banks get going. The other thing is on the online experience, the online shopping experience from a payment perspective stinks. It's awful. I'm embarrassed by it. It's Bloomberg last week, I used a term called the NASCARization. When you go to check out at an online site, there's all these different options. It's scary. You know, you don't know what to do. It's what's happening online is the moral equivalent that if we made a business have to have a separate terminal for American Express, a separate terminal for Visa, a separate terminal for MasterCard, separate terminal for Discover, they would tell us that we're crazy or something worse. That's what we're doing in the online world. There's a different setup for Visa versus American Express versus MasterCard versus Discover. It's horrible. And there's already too much of a problem in terms of people shopping and then dropping out when they go to actually buy. So I've publicly stated that we're 100% behind a new initiative to have a common button where if you want to check out, there's a common button that works for every payment instrument. You hit the button, it will bring up, in essence, a wallet. So it will show you any of the credit cards you've preloaded. It could be one card or it could be five. One of them probably would be set to your default. You press the one you want and then the shipping information will come up and you confirm it. So three quick pushes of the button. Push the button to say I want to buy, push the button for the card I want, push the button to confirm. And we've got to make this experience a lot better for customers, which means all of us as an industry have to suck it up and get away from our own personal view of having how our own brand is represented and our own technology and move to a single standard solution. And we'll get there, and certainly as to the degree I have something to say about it, we'll get there as fast as we can.
Ella, do you see a day that the paper currency is no longer in existence, or do you see maybe only 10% of it left?
It's a good question, John. It was funny, I had breakfast this morning with Jonathan Kraft, and we were having this exact conversation and talking about why some people actually do continue to use cash. I think cash will go down. you know, I think businesses are, so first of all, e-commerce is training people. Like even my mother's, who's 88, has been trained that and realizes that she can't stuff cash into her computer. Just there's no place to stuff cash. So if she actually wants to buy, and she doesn't get out that much anymore, she wants to buy, she's got to use a payment credential of some kind of credit card. Governments are becoming increasingly activist. I met recently with President Sisi, the president of Egypt in Cairo, and he's determined. Cairo, by the way, if you don't know, is a country with Egypt's a country with almost 100 million people, and a huge amount of them live in poverty. And so about 70% of the people in Egypt are on some kind of government subsidy program. And today it's all done with paper vouchers. And so President Sisi realizes, A, that's inefficient, and B, it contributes to a continuing gray economy out there that where people are, in essence, are hiding their money from the government. And so he wants to convert that so that they can go out and they can pay people on either Visa debit cards or prepaid cards, which then will force a whole bunch of businesses to have to stop just taking cash and take credit cards. So there's a lot of activist governments. The other thing is people are starting to realize how expensive cash is. Yeah. It's expensive to store it, it's expensive to count it, it's expensive to transport it. It's just plain and simple expensive. And you'll find, I'm sure there's one in Boston, I don't know where it is, but in most major cities there are entrepreneurs who have opened stores and they've gone cashless. And I think increasingly, particularly young people will realize just how darn expensive the cost of cash is. Ask Brian, I don't know who's going to interview him. Somebody should ask Brian Moynihan when he's here how expensive cash is for Bank of America. And he'll tell you it's staggering, yeah. Staggering. So I do think there's a lot of forces that are driving cash out of the system. But last year, more money was spent on cash than 5 years ago. The percentage has changed. In fact, last year was the first time that electronic or digital payments were more than cash, but yet the absolute amount of money spent on cash around the world was actually higher last year than 5 years ago. So I'm not sure it's going to happen in my tenure as CEO of Visa that we're going to see cashless around the world.
Interesting. When you think about companies, Al, like Visa, that have a large footprint, in a tremendous global brand, you see a lot of things that go on out there in the world, the economic environment. Can you provide us with any insights as to what you see over the next year or 2 years in the global economy? And is there anything as relates to that that concerns you?
Well, it looks really good. I mean, we think that global growth will be about 3.3% this year at the end of the year. We do think it will drop a little bit in 19 to 3.2, 3.1. We think it'll be around 3% in 2020. Those are healthy levels. Oh, yeah. It's hard to find a developing or developed economy around the world that's struggling. Obviously, there's big issues both in Venezuela and Argentina right now. But outside of those two countries, for the most part, the big economies are doing well. Even Brazil, you know, I would have said three quarters ago that Brazil would be a country that wasn't kind of keeping up with everybody else, but it's looked good the last three quarters. In the United States, I think tax reform has helped. Yeah. I do worry in the United States about the impacts of the trade situation. I worry about immigration a lot. I worry about some early signs of inflation growth and whether they will temper the impacts, the positive impacts of tax reform. I think it's possible. The biggest concern I have is a lot of what's going on in the world right now is people are really moving from country to country. There's never been a period in our lifetime where more people are going from whatever their home country is to another country. And so if you ask me my biggest fear, and that's a good thing for us, when people are traveling, particularly overseas, it's a really good thing for Visa, and it's a good thing for the world. I worry about some geopolitical shock that would ground or make people think about taking that trip outside of their country. That would be my single biggest concern as I look out over the next couple of years.
It's interesting, in the Wall Street Journal, the reported the other day, consumer confidence is at an all-time high.
Yep.
And that's sort of a harbinger of what's to follow in the next couple of quarters, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Exactly.
But again, I think you're right about the issue. Is there some type of external force that could cause that? Do you want to just briefly comment on tariffs? Do those impact your business at all?
Not in the short term. Yeah. You know, it really depends. If consumers actually are willing to pay the tariffs, yeah, it's a good thing for us because the average ticket would go up. But if consumers choose to stop buying things because the tariffs add too much of an incremental cost to the item they're going to purchase, it's a bad thing for us. That's kind of a very transactional answer. In the long term, there's better ways to deal with it than these tariffs. And I was telling John or somebody earlier, I met with the foreign minister of China who was leading their delegation to the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. And they're extraordinarily unhappy with the United States right now. And so, but I don't think anything's going to happen until after the midterm elections.
Yeah. Interesting, a question that's near and dear to everybody in this room and any CEO, I think, in America, any upcoming business leader is really the concept of leadership. And people often, you know, have different styles of leadership. And you've obviously had a very, very clear style of leadership. I spoke to some of your trustees, members of your board, before we came here today, and they talked about you being very, very direct, very honest, very sincere, and very inspirational. And so you've got this unique style. How do you sort of drive down that style of leadership amongst your leadership team to ensure you have alignment of values?
So I start from a premise that whether you've got a charity board or a Boy Scout or Girl Scout troop or a Fortune 500 company, it's all about people. You can't be successful without the right people. Mm-hmm. And if you care about people, and you care about talent, you have to care about leadership. You just have to. And I, on my very first day as the CEO of Visa, I sent a letter to the top 900 people in the company laying out my expectations of them and telling them that if my expectations of what I expected of them of leaders didn't match theirs, they ought to consider moving on. And we have now established a set of leadership principles in the company. And we're going through our year-end cycle this year. And for the first time, everybody in our company will get two ratings, one based on how they did versus their goals, and the other based on how they did in terms of leadership. And everybody, all 17,000, everybody's a leader. You know, even if you don't have anybody reporting to you, if you're going to get your job done, you got to lead. You got to lead through influence management. You got to lead through collaboration. You got to lead through communication. And everybody will get a second rating on their leadership and their leadership behaviors. And those two ratings will count equally in people's year-end compensation bonuses. So I'd say there's two things I'm trying to do. One is it's a subject, as I say, within Visa, I'm not going away on. I talk about leadership all the time. I teach leadership classes. I've been teaching a leadership class called the 10 C's of Leadership since I first gave a speech on 8 C's of Leadership in 1998, and then I got bombarded with all kinds of words beginning with C that I should add to my list of 8, and I subsequently did add 2 more, so I do a class on the 10 C's of leadership. So I talk about it all the time. I've moved on people in positions of authority that weren't living up to our leadership principles, our values, and you don't like to do those things, but they set a direction. And then I think by directly tying this to people's compensation, it tends to get people's attention. So I think those are the ways that I try to make sure that what I believe, which is I believe deeply in servant leadership. It's not people's jobs to respect me because I happen to be the CEO. It's my job to earn their respect on a day in and day out basis based on how I act, what my values are, and what I do. And that's exactly what I expect our leaders and the leaders below them to behave in a similar fashion.
Servant leadership is a pretty inspirational phrase when you really think about it, and for the greater good as well, too. I'm going to ask one last question, Al, and really, what do you think the greater challenges right now facing CEOs, both in America and around the globe?
I think there are two that come to mind for me, John. One is talent, back to talent. I constantly worry about, do I have the right team on the field, and am I deploying them in the proper fashion? Am I putting the best people against the highest leveraged return initiatives? The other is managing your time. You know, I worry about the balance between how much time I spend on tactical stuff versus strategic stuff, how much time I spend externally versus how much time I spend internally. I worry about how much time I spend on business versus with my family. You know, I worry about whether I'm keeping up with my health and making sure, which I try to do every day, that I find a window, even if it's at some ridiculous hour, to work out. Because I think it's hard to have one of these jobs unless you're healthy and you're dedicated to your personal wellness. So I think, you know, I always worry about whether I'm balancing my time properly, and often coming home in the evening, whether it's in a car or when I'm in San Francisco walking, you know, I kind of think about how did I spend my day and did I spend it in the most productive fashion? And for the most part, I think I do, but it's a question I don't think any of us actually really knows. You just try to do the best you can, but you have to think about it a lot.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I just want to close my, and then we'll probably open up some questions and say, in my introduction, I talked about Al's kids, and I talked about how they've been raised and the successes that Al and his family have had. And I said the kids would be very, very proud of the dad if they saw our dad up here today. I would say that all of us at Boston College are extremely proud of you.
Well, thank you, John.
We can't thank you enough for the work you do on our board, the work you do for our country, the ambassadorship that you show our country. And for all of our people here, too, I just want to congratulate and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure Al would like to take a few questions. If we could just, people raise their hand, there's microphones that we could, right over here.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, there you are.
Hey there. Yeah,
want to come out a little bit? Yeah.
I just wondered if you had a perspective on blockchain, and is it going to change the financial services world as we know it?
You know, it's an interesting technology. It isn't really, at its core, for us, a good technology. Blockchain is set a technology that's really designed to handle a low volume, high value transactions. It's not a technology, for instance, that we could change our processing systems. Blockchain could never do 65,000 transactions a second. That's not what it's geared for. But we are looking at blockchain and general ledger, you know, the ledgering type of capability of it to help us in the B2B space where you have transactions that could be tracked over time and have the benefit, there's a benefit of them being transparent. We have 275 PhDs in Palo Alto in a place that we call Visa Research. It's about if you're a golfer, it's probably like a 7-iron from the front gates of Stanford. And that's where we're spending, all they do, they're paid to do, is think about 5 years out, and they're looking at artificial intelligence and machine language and blockchain and quantum computing, et cetera. So it's something we're looking closely at.
John is over here.
John?
Thank you. Al, would you comment on cryptocurrencies and the use of cryptocurrencies in your business and what you think the future of cryptocurrencies might be?
So at the risk of being controversial, I think cryptocurrencies are a commodity, not a payment vehicle, at least right now. And I think they're a fairly speculative commodity. We happen to have a belief that our philosophy is we will only settle in fiat currencies. And deal with currencies that are tied to some open market where there's transparency on how that currency is trading. You know, if you look at what happened to, you know, Bitcoin's been as high as, 27,000 and down at much, much lower numbers. It remains to be seen. We're gonna keep our eye on it as it goes. It's hard to tell, but right now I think of it as much more a commodity than I do a payment instrument. Yeah. Sir?
Yeah, Devin Kincaid of Micronauts. Just a question, just along the lines of machine learning, beyond fraud detection and prevention, how do you see machine learning and AI furthering the Visa mission, if at all?
Well, certainly we spend a lot of time worried about fraud and risk management because fraud is a huge problem in the industry. And in certain pockets, it's a huge problem. And we spend a lot of time thinking about risk management. You know, for instance, the sports betting that's becoming legal in the United States. Well, most of the risk systems in the United States are not geared up to handle sports betting. They're not. They don't have enough data points to understand exactly how somebody will behave who might bet on sports. So actually, one of the things that's going to hold back sports betting in the short term will be that the banks are going to be very reticent to approve a lot of sports betting transactions until they're able to build up more experience with them. I think the other place that artificial intelligence and machine language are going to play a role is in data and analytics. You can imagine that we see an awful lot of data and have an awful lot of data. And you know, data is useless unless you can turn data into insights. And as I talk to our data folks, I don't want to hear how many data elements we have or how much storage we take up, et cetera. I want them to talk to me about insights, things that are going to make a difference for our clients, are going to make a difference for consumers, are going to make a difference for citizens around the world. And I do think that artificial intelligence and machine language will give us a huge technological step up there.
Al, who would pay to develop the common button for online purchases?
Well, there's a standard-setting body called EMVCO, not very glamorous or sexy term, but it's a standard-setting body that's the intellectual property of it is owned by the major networks around the world, the ones you would expect me to say, plus something like JCB, which is the major network in Japan. So, and we, each of the companies, Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover, JCB, et cetera, have representatives who sit on the standards board. And the standards board sets the standards. And then it will be largely the expense of each of us in the network companies like Visa to actually spend the money to make it a reality.
Thank you.
With that, I'm just going to say thank you, Al. I know we're running short on time. And we really do appreciate you being in Boston. Safe travels back, and we'd love to have you back again.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring Al Kelly, Chairman and CEO of Visa. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.